Stand, please.
Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals, the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its honorable court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-3119. Right hand, left, also known as the state attorney. Is that the appellate, yes or no?
Morning, counsel.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Marielle Goetz. I'm representing the appellant, John Smith, and I'm going to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I'd like to start off this morning by talking about the issues we've raised with respect to the testimony of FBI agent John Bevington. And the first issue I'd like to discuss is the testimony he provided at the very outset of trial when he stated that Mr. Smith was working together with the leader of the conspiracy to buy heroin in New York. This testimony is exactly like the overview testimony that three other circuits have held to be improper. First of all, it allowed the prosecution to repeat its opening statement to the jury, bolstering its theory of the case. But the critical distinction is that when Agent Bevington was up there testifying, he was providing the jury with actual evidence that they could rely on in reaching their verdict, whereas with the opening statements, the jury was instructed that arguments are not evidence. The testimony also achieved the same effect as prosecutorial vouching. Agent Bevington was testifying based on his own opinion of Mr. Smith's guilt, backed by his position as a government officer.
The government argues that this is different because, from the cases you cite, because this was based on the agent's personal perceptions, his own listening to the calls, and was not kind of overview based on information from other agents and other parts of the investigation. You want to respond to that?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, I think that is not supported. That claim is not supported by the record. Agent Bevington had just completed, right before he began this testimony, he just completed explaining all of the various roles he played in the investigation, how the investigation proceeded, and that it in fact depended on a collective effort of a wide range of individuals. So I think that, first of all, in this case, the record doesn't support the claim that he was testifying only on the basis of his personal perceptions. And I think this is a claim that in the other cases actually specifically rejected. The government made that claim in those cases as well. And if you look at the Garcia case, the Second Circuit, that was the testimony where the agent stated the defendant was working as a partner with someone else in the conspiracy. And that court reviewed the same claim, and they concluded that the record simply didn't support that claim, especially where he had just finished testifying about the various collective efforts of the team of individuals involved in the investigation. But second of all, I don't think the logic supporting condemning the overview testimony necessarily depends on that testimony being based on hearsay, information from informants, or so forth. It's improper because it violates all three of the prongs of Rule 701. The first one being personal knowledge, but the second one, perhaps most importantly, being that it's not helpful to the jury because it simply tells them what result to reach rather than...
Well, that, I'm not sure that's your best argument. That could be said of any expert testimony, could it not? I mean, isn't that helpful to the jury?
Well,
it helps them decide the case.
What the other circuits have said examining this testimony is that it's not helpful to the jury because it goes too far. And if that kind of testimony were helpful to the jury, then any witness, expert or lay, could get up there and tell them not only what the evidence was.
If they met the other prongs. But if the testimony of the witness is, for example, confusing or doesn't really go to the issue before the jury, then you can say it's not helpful to the jury. But I'm not sure that I follow the logic of saying, well, this is not helpful to the jury because it would help them decide the case. That seems to me to be a contradiction in one sentence.
The problem isn't that it would help the jury, that it wouldn't help the jury in some sense decide the case. The problem is that it would help them too much, Your Honor.
That may be better, or help
them to decide on a different basis than they're instructed to do so.
Exactly, and on a different basis than perhaps the evidence that's actually adduced at trial supports. But one thing Your Honor said I think is worth repeating, which is that is, you know, there are two other prongs to Rule 701, and I think, you know, none of the three prongs were met in this case. I think another problem with the testimony is that the jury may have believed that Agent Bemington was not stating his own mere opinion, but was stating facts, things that actually happened. And again,
it would have mattered if his testimony had come later in the trial, that is to say, after the introduction of the wiretap results.
I don't think that in that case, Your Honor, I don't think the testimony would have been quite as prejudicial as it was, but I do think it still would have been wrong because, again, none of the three requirements of Rule 701 were met. That said, I think it was particularly harmful coming as the very first evidence that the government presented with respect to Mr. Smith. This was the first thing they heard about him was the lead agent in the investigation testifying that he was in cahoots with not just anyone in the conspiracy, but the leader of the conspiracy. And so I think it was particularly harmful, the fact that it came before any tapes were played for the jury, before they perhaps could have reached that conclusion independently of Agent Bevington's opinion. And so I think it presented the jury with a lens of guilt through which they probably viewed the entirety of the case after that point. And I'd like to move on now to the other issue relating his testimony, which has to do with his extensive interpretation of the wiretaps. And I'd like to start off by talking about this circuit's recent decision in the case of United States v. Wilson just a few months ago. That case presented a somewhat slightly different situation, but involved basically the same issues, which was the defendant had presented witnesses to testify as lay witnesses to interpret wiretaps. And what this panel held was that those witnesses could not testify mainly because he did not have any personal knowledge basis in that conspiracy, but also, I think, because his testimony would have been based on his specialized knowledge, and that's exactly what we're arguing here. And now, if you look at the cases that the opinion cited in that case, which is Garcia, the Second Circuit case, and the Figueroa-Lopez case from, I think, the Ninth Circuit, those two cases, as well as the Eighth Circuit case from Oreido, those three cases actually support the holding that we're asking you to make in this case, which is that even when a testifying agent has personal involvement in the investigation and perhaps may have some personal knowledge basis for the testimony, but even in those situations, it's still not permissible as lay opinion testimony because it is based on his extensive past experience as a law enforcement officer. And I think
let's assume you're right about that. Can you address the prejudice argument that
yes,
the government
Your Honor.
Raises?
Well, first of all, I think that if this panel finds that the testimony was improperly admitted as lay opinion testimony, which we submit it was, then I think the next step in the process is engaging in a harmless error inquiry. Mm-hmm. And as this panel has, not this panel, but as this court has repeatedly said, when engaging in this harmless error inquiry, the question is not whether what could have happened in another trial, what the government could have presented, whether the government could have presented another expert witness to provide the same testimony, or whether had the jury been presented with just the calls and not the interpretations, it still could have made the same decision it did. That's not at all the question this panel is supposed to be looking at. What the panel is supposed to be deciding is, did this particular jury in this case actually rely on the improper interpretations versus the other evidence in the case?
Well, that's true, but it
would be on. Go ahead.
You can go ahead. It's true, but it would have come in anyway. It just would have been come in as expert testimony.
No, Your Honor, we don't concede that the testimony would have come in anyway.
I know you don't concede that, but if it had, let's assume it could have come in anyway as expert testimony.
Well, I think if it could have come in as expert testimony, saying that alone doesn't get you to the point where it would have been proper for Agent Bevington to testify not only as to his factual involvement in the investigation, but also to render these expert opinions. And I think if you look at the Lopez-Medina case, which was a case in the Sixth Circuit, that court found that even though the case agent had testified as an expert witness in that case and offered extensive opinion testimony, nonetheless, it was plain error for the court to not adequately provide instructions to the jury about how to weigh the lay testimony and the fact testimony versus the expert testimony. And I think in this case, you would have run into the same problem, which is, on the one hand, the agent was testifying about things he knew, things he observed, things he heard, but then immediately, you know, interwoven with all of that fact testimony was testimony that was pure opinion testimony, his own opinion, drawing from his experience and other knowledge he had, and speculation. And I think that the jury in this case was never told, you know, it was told for the other experts that testified at trial, for example, the chemist and the fingerprinting expert and so forth. These are experts who are allowed to testify to opinions because of their specialized knowledge. And if you don't credit any of that knowledge or any of that background, you are fully free to disregard the opinion or discount its weight. And that's the proper opinion to give when an expert testifies. And because Judge Hogan didn't view this law enforcement agent to be testifying as an expert, never even considered, you know, issuing an instruction on that issue. And so I think we just can't say on this record that the jury was adequately equipped to weigh his opinions in this case. And so I think even if you consider his testimony that could have come in permissibly from an expert, I don't think it's fair to say that allowing Agent Bevington to testify in this dual capacity would have been allowed. And certainly on this record, there was no effort made to demarcate the portions of his testimony in which he was rendering these opinions and the other portions of his testimony in which he was talking about facts. And I'd like to move on now, just because we're running a little short on time, to the Confrontation Clause issue. First of all, I think this issue was absolutely preserved on this record. Counsel repeatedly mentioned the seminal U.S. Supreme Court case of United States v. Crawford v. Washington on four separate occasions. And even if you disregard the specific references to Crawford, I think her repeated expression of a need to cross-examine the witness, and she even used the word confront at one point, I think there can be no question that this issue was preserved in the lower court for this panel to resolve on appeal. And once that's recognized, I think if you look at the certificates themselves, there's no question that they're not testimonial hearsay evidence. There's also no question that there was no prior opportunity for cross-examination or confrontation before trial.
The only argument would be that nobody said there was cross-examination opportunity, but are they in fact testimonial? What did these certificates exactly say?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think if you look at the certificates, they're dated just 1 month before trial. It clearly states on the face of the document, the clerk or whoever prepared the document, you know, that's one of the issues we don't really know for sure, said, it appears from an examination of the records. We don't know who actually conducted the examination.
That's a different question, though. Suppose we knew who it was or didn't know who it was. Is that a testimonial document?
Yes, Your Honor.
If it were simply a certificate that said the records of, showed a picture of the records of Podunk County and it showed a conviction under this name, that would not be testimonial, would it?
No, Your Honor. I think that would be testimonial.
So you don't think even a prior conviction certificate is non-testimonial?
I think if you look at what the Supreme Court said, Justice Scalia in Melendez-Diaz, he talked about this exception for a clerk's letter authenticating a certified copy of, I think, the judgment or the certified conviction.
That was what I thought I was both hypothesizing.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I think the only thing that would not be testimonial hearsay under that definition is a letter from the clerk certifying to the authenticity of an attached copy. And this is certainly not what we have in this case. What we have is this document prepared by the clerk, and this is exactly what Justice Scalia said the clerk could not do under this historical exception, was certify to the substance or effect or state what the record appeared to show. And that's exactly what these certificates do. And so I don't think there can be any question that the certificates are testimonial, Your Honor.
Was this case tried after that decision was rendered?
No, Your Honor. This case was tried in 2007. Melendez-Diaz came down in 2009. But I do believe that even the prior cases of Crawford and Washington sufficiently explained what a testimonial statement was, and they said it's something where the person making the statement...
I don't think it would matter. I mean, if this case, it only helps explain why the court perhaps proceeded as it did, but the subsequent decision is, I think, pretty clearly applicable.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's exactly right. It doesn't matter that it was decided after trial. We preserved the objection, and this court needs to apply the law as it stands today. And I see I'm running into, I'm almost out of time, and so I'd like to sit down and reserve my time for rebuttal, unless there are further
questions. We're not very careful about the division of time between direct and rebuttal. We'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Unless my colleagues have further questions, we will, and seeing none, we'll hear from, we'll hear from the government.
May it please the Court, Patricia Heffernan on behalf of the United States. It actually does matter in this case when Melendez-Diaz was decided, because it's the government's position, and I think if the Court takes a look at the sum totality of the transcript where the issue of the certificates was discussed, we don't debate that the word Crawford was used, but it's quite plain that the trial court did not understand appellant to be raising a Sixth Amendment challenge to these certificates. And I would expressly point the court to the transcript of April 2nd in the afternoon at pages 7 through 10, which is when the court issued its ruling and twice summarized what it understood the objection to be. And the objection it understood was a 902 evidentiary and hearsay objection. And the reliability.
Crawford's a confrontation clause case.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it was brought up four times.
That's right.
You're bringing up a case that's solely about, a landmark case about the confrontation clause.
The judge says, I know about Crawford.
The judge says, I know about Crawford. Our point is, as the court has already discussed, Judge Hogan never addressed the issue of whether or not these documents were testimonial.
Mm-hmm. But if counsel below raised Crawford, a Crawford objection means a confrontation clause objection, doesn't it?
The best I can say, because the discussion was so convoluted, I would just ask the court to read the sum totality of the transcripts, because really that's the only way you can get a flavor for the kind of inartful comments about Crawford that were being made and how they were resonating.
There, I know about Crawford. And a Crawford objection is a confrontation clause objection, isn't it?
I would, Your Honor, at the end of the day, when Judge Hogan issued his ruling focusing solely on 902, it was incumbent upon defense counsel to say, now the court's disposed of the hearsay objection, let's move on to the Sixth Amendment objection, which is a separate objection, and we need
I
to address that.
I don't know that sounds very realistic to me.
Well, perhaps we might not have been able to get that much out, but I think something could have been said to have flagged to the court that there are two separate objections being raised here. But moving on to the
problem. Go ahead. I don't think that the citation to Crawford was enough.
Not in the context of the arguments that were being made. But moving on from the preservation argument and discussing very briefly, with respect to the certificates, if the court finds that the objection is preserved, we would agree that there is that it was harmful with respect to the felon in possession count, but it was not. There was no spillover prejudice with respect to the other counts. The evidence against appellant was overwhelming, and all the jury heard was that some 20 years ago, appellant was convicted of some unidentified offense, one of which resulted in a sentence which appears to be probation, and the other of which was simply a 16-to-3-year sentence some 20 years ago. And in the face of the evidence against appellant with respect to the other charges, we would strongly argue, as we do in our brief, that any Crawford error, if the court found one to be preserved, is not prejudicial. And so we do make, briefly touching on a suggestion for a remand. If the court were to find this preserved, if the court agrees with the government that the error is not prejudicial with respect to the other counts, then we would be happy to have the 922G conviction vacated and the other convictions affirmed. We're only concerned about any kind of taint with respect to the other charges. And in that case, it would be incumbent for a determination to be made whether these documents were testimonial, which is a depends on facts, certain factual findings that the district court didn't make. Moving on to the very briefly, the interpretation argument. Again, these arguments.
Excuse me one second. Going back to the waiver question for just a second. Why wasn't it enough for when counsel said, I need the clerk in here to cross-examine her regarding what it is she's looking at to make a statement that Mr. Smith has a prior record? This is just basically a letter with a seal on it stating that somebody looked at her record.
We don't dispute that. Our argument, Your Honor, is that the court at the end, the defense counsel did not press for a ruling on the Crawford argument, and the court didn't.
How about, I'm talking about two legal issues. One is Crawford.
One is Crawford.
It just says a chemist's report cannot come in.
Right.
Under the rules of evidence, if it were the actual record, I probably would not have an objection to it being authentic based on the seal, but I am objecting to the hearsay.
Objecting to the hearsay.
Well, isn't that the confrontation? That's what it's about, isn't it?
I agree that both of those terms were being used. And if you take little snippets of what is said, it certainly looks a lot stronger. But our real preservation argument is at the end of the day, Judge Hogan didn't address the question whether these documents were testimonial. And as appellant concedes, has to concede, there's nothing in the record about these documents.
Didn't we look at them and tell whether they're testimonial or not?
I don't think so.
What different could you put on remand? You can't change the nature of the document. And if the document is a statement by the clerk that the record appears to show X, isn't that testimonial?
I think that's an assumption about what these documents are.
It's not an assumption. It's what it says, isn't it?
Yes,
I looked at the document, and I don't have it right here, but that's what I recall.
I would not deem to dispute with you what the language in the documents mm-hmm. is. But we know from the Second Circuit's opinion in Green how these documents were created. And
How do we know how these documents were created?
Because they're the exact same documents. The documents are created by statute. There's a statute, a New York State statute, that provides for how these documents provides for the provision of these documents. And the court in Green.
Would it not have been possible for the clerk to have certified the attached is a true copy of the records of Suffolk County or whatever county it was, and attached a certified copy of the judgment? Would that not have been possible?
I can't speak for what the clerk of that courthouse would have done mm-hmm. Had that specific request been made. But
you can speak for the agency that requested it.
I understand, and boy, we would.
So my question remains: would it not have been possible to produce such a document?
I don't know. I don't know what documents.
Refused to so certify, your subpoena runs with the flag. Could you not have subpoenaed the clerk or representative from that county, Dukas Tecum, all records pertaining to Mr. Smith?
If the issue was before the court and the court and the government were on notice that there's a big dispute about whether
you knew more about the case, or I don't mean you personally, your office knew more about the case than anybody else in the world. What do you mean on notice? You were on notice of every fact in this case. It's your case. The defense may not be on notice of a lot of things. The judge doesn't know anything until they get to the courtroom usually, but you knew everything about the case. You were on notice.
That's right. And the prosecutor, in the prosecutor's view, these documents were tantamount. They were certified convictions. It wasn't until mid-trial.
That's the problem. They're not certified convictions.
It's not a certified copy of the judgment. I agree.
It's a letter saying what the records appear to show.
That's the language yeah. in the document. In Green.
That's troubling, isn't it?
If the court were to look at Green, where the court actually made findings about how the documents, what these documents are. They're computer-generated documents. And it reads as though this is the language.
Is that evidence before the court here?
No. Again, it's the government's position. That's because the question of whether or not the documents were testimonial was not litigated in the trial court.
Green had some difficulty with the document. Second Circuit had some difficulty with the document.
That's right. There was one difficulty that the Green court pointed out, which is pre-1990, there was the section of the provision under which somebody was convicted. If that wasn't entered, there was a default, Section 1 entered. In this case, the appellant was convicted under Section 220.06, and every single section under that provision is a class, states a violation of a Class D felony. And all Class D felonies under 70.70 of the code involve a sentence of a year to a year and a, 2.5 years. So in this case, the sole issue, computer glitch issue, that Green pointed out does not come into play here.
Would have been nice to explore those things on the record, wouldn't it?
I agree, Your Honor. And again, not to beat a dead horse, but I think we would have if we had been on.
Isn't that consistent with the purpose of the Confrontation Clause to be able to explore such things on the record?
It is. And I think that, again.
If they couldn't explore such things on the record, they can't be faulted for bringing a Crawford challenge, can they?
I'm sorry?
Since they couldn't explore those on the record, it sounds a lot like a Crawford case, doesn't it?
I think they could have been explored on the record. I think if counsel had simply said these documents.
Tell me how the cross-examination would have gone on the clerk.
But the clerk.
She wasn't there.
That's right. But if defense counsel had said, these are testimonial documents, as opposed to, I want to confront the clerk. I think these are hearsay. I think this is unreliable. I don't
think this is a Crawford issue. I think this is a Crawford issue.
I agree.
You go to you go to criminal law seminars and symposia like I do, right? Don't you?
I wish I
don't you do some CLE?
No, we don't get to do that.
You don't? Okay. You at least sit around the table and drink coffee and talk about criminal law. Maybe you don't drink coffee, but in any event, when you say a Crawford case, you know what it means, don't you?
That's right. Your Honor, again, the best I can say is we do think this was buried in a substantial hearsay objection.
The law has changed in a direction that's not favorable to you and post the trial. So
that's right.
We're going to have to deal with that.
Yes, that's correct. Thank you.
Why did this problem bleed over into the other gun offense?
Why did it or why did it not?
You can take it either way.
I'm sorry. We say it did not. I wasn't sure that I could hear Your Honor, but it did not. The evidence against appellant was overwhelming, which we chronicled. But the short hit is that you've got this phone call where he's complaining about how his girlfriend looked out the window and saw him get stopped by the police and the canine running for his truck. And he's complaining about his term, you got to wait till they hit the door until you flush the shit down the toilet. And that's just like flushing money, clearly a reference to drugs. He's found alone in his house at 6 o'clock in the morning with 316 grams of heroin, two firearms, and $27,000. There were all of these other phone calls that the jury heard and corroborated by surveillance. And again, these convictions are unidentified convictions that are some 20 years old and appear, by all appearances, were quite minor. So under those circumstances.
Right. but it's a gun offense, and he's got a gun offense here, right? Mm-hmm. The 20-year-old offense is a gun offense.
No, it isn't.
Oh, it's not?
No, it's not a gun offense. It was an unidentified offense. The jury didn't learn the nature of the offense. That was redacted. But, in fact, it was a controlled substance offense and an assault offense. But both the nature of both of those offenses were redacted.
Simple assault?
Yeah.
I actually have, let me see if I have the unredacted.
That aggravated assault of some kind, wouldn't it?
But in any event, the jury didn't learn the nature of those were redacted, that the offense was redacted in the certificates that went back to the jury. Shifting over briefly to the interpretation, here the objection was plainly not preserved. The objection at trial was, you shouldn't let the jury hear this lay opinion testimony because it doesn't need it. There are only 30 calls. The jury can interpret the calls for themselves. There was never at any point an objection that we think what the agent is going to be doing is testifying based on his experience rather than the calls. He was never, and in fact, in the transcript on March 31st in the afternoon at page 11, I believe it was, Bevington expressly testified. The question was, what is the basis of your knowledge? And the answer is the telephone calls. Counsel never.
Yeah, but that doesn't really make sense. when he's telling what the definitions of terms are in the drug culture, it can't follow that his knowledge comes from listening to this one set of phones.
I'm talking about the preservation issue. Now, moving into the specific testimony that's complained about.
Yeah.
When Bevington testified that dope meant heroin and that key meant kilo, there was no objection. So at that point, it was incumbent on defense counsel to say, hang on a second, this was admitted as lay testimony under 701. He's testifying based on his expertise. That objection was never raised.
Hadn't that been raised pretrial and the district judge had rejected it?
Well, yeah, no,
not as to the specific, but the general.
The government made a motion in limine pretrial that brought that before the court.
The government made a motion in limine in which we said that his interpretation about the meaning of the calls was going to be based on his personal perceptions. And the court ruled that would be the proper subject of lay opinion testimony. And the court even flagged that if he was to testify based on his experience rather than on his personal perceptions, that would be improper. He'd have to be an expert at that point.
But when he gets the dope, he says, in my experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And there's a reason for that. And the reason is they were happy to have all of this evidence come in, happy to have Bevington, because the theory was, you're going to hear these drug terms. Let's make it clear for the jury these are drug terms. And that's important because none of those terms are in the conversations involving this defendant. And the government got it wrong because all of these other conversations are about drugs. And they assumed that Mr. Smith, too, was conspiring. But when you look at the calls, you'll see that there are no drug terms. And that is why I would direct the court's attention March 31st in the afternoon between pages 17 and 21. The prosecutor, this is one of the very first calls, runs through a whole series of questions. What does water mean to you? What does boat mean to you? Snorting, sniffing, and a whole series of drug terms. And that's why later on in the trial, defense counsel has Agent Bevington offer all sorts of testimony about various drug terms, and that's why this clearly isn't preserved. They weren't complaining about that in the trial court. They were happy to have this testimony.
So your argument here is not so much that there's no error in the admission of the opinions of Bevington, but that any error was harmless. Is that?
Well, I'm making several combined.
Yes, you are. That's what I'm trying to get a handle on.
First of all, our initial.
I don't blame you.
It's not preserved, and it would be that it's not plain because the court's opinion in Wilson had not been issued at trial at the time of trial, and the circuits were split on the question. And obviously there's no prejudice because this is exactly the kind of testimony they wanted out. And if they had objected, the jury was going to hear this testimony no matter what, either through Bevington or through Washington, that they were on notice that this testimony was coming. We provided expert notice in advance of trial, and we said Agent Washington is going to offer testimony on these topics. And so they were on notice. They knew that testimony was coming at trial regardless. And just briefly on the suggestion of dual capacity being per se error, the court said in Catlett it's not. The Ninth Circuit said in Freeman it's not. And again, that really is a separate complaint that was not raised at trial, and it's not plain error here. Briefly, did Your Honor have a question?
Yeah. Isn't it, in fact, error to put on that kind of testimony without qualifying as an expert?
It is if there's an objection to it. I mean, this
No. That's a different question. I take that as a yes.
If it's error. The federal rules. Yes.
Hold it a minute.
Yes.
The question concerned whether it was error or not, not whether there had been an objection. Since you said it is if there had been an objection, I take that as a yes, that it was erroneous to put this on. It just hadn't been objected to, is your position.
Well, I'd like to qualify that. It happens all the time.
I know it.
That parties are happy to have evidence. Here's, for example, hearsay evidence. If it can come in. The whole question is whether or not somebody cares that it comes in. But if everybody wants it in, then it comes in. And that's, I think, important for the court to not lose sight of. But if we were to march through 702 after Wilson, we would agree that if an agent is testifying based on his experience in other investigations and his experience as a narcotics investigator, as opposed to simply his personal perceptions in the case, after Wilson, that yes, If there were an objection, we would have to satisfy Rule 702. And, of course, we could have done that here.
And it would have still come in either Bevington dual capacity or Washington.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. No question. And then just briefly touching on the overview, just a couple of points I wanted to
make. Can you distinguish Garcia in that regard?
Can I distinguish Garcia? Mm-hmm. Yes. Again, Garcia was a case where the agent was testified based on the total information developed by all of the officials. This case is not exactly like any of the cases cited. In this case, he's testifying, the single sentence that's complained about is based on his own personal perception, and that takes this case outside the realm of Garcia, Casas, Griffin, I think it was Flores de Jesus, all of those cases which involve the agent testifying on information beyond his personal knowledge. And briefly, with respect to the bolstering.
Well, now we have now reached and passed the end of your allotted time. If my colleagues have questions or wish to hear you briefly, then we'll let you proceed. But otherwise, I'll cut you off.
Hearing no questions.
Hearing none, then none.
We'd ask that the judgment be affirmed. Thank you.
Okay. We'll give back 2 minutes for rebuttal to the appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of things. First of all, I think that the Supreme Court's decision in Davis v. Washington makes it clear that what we did here was more than sufficient to preserve the Confrontation Clause objection. There's no obligation to mention the word testimonial in that case. Counsel simply said there was no opportunity to cross-examine the person, and the Supreme Court held that was sufficient.
Can you address the question whether it's error, harmless as to the other counts?
Yes, Your Honor. That was what I was going to move on to next. First of all, if you find that it was error, it would be constitutional error, and the government would have the burden to show beyond a reasonable doubt not only that this evidence affected the felon in possession count, but I'm sorry, that this evidence didn't contribute to the jury's verdict on any of the other counts. And I just think, I think that given the fact that the circuit has repeatedly said that when you join a felon in possession count, you do risk considerable prejudice from the evidence coming in on that count on those other counts, I think the fact that there were two convictions or alleged convictions admitted to the jury, and the fact that we are, you know, given our other
convictions, the jury doesn't know what they're about, and the evidence here is strong on the other counts, very strong.
Well, Your Honor, I think given our arguments that some of that other evidence, in fact, most of the powerful evidence was improperly admitted, I don't think it's necessarily true.
Right. If you win on those, that's a different story. But just if you just won on the Crawford issue.
Yes, okay. I think that the other factor to consider is the fact that the judge in this case, when you're looking at the effect these convictions had on the other verdict, there actually was no explicit instruction that the jury should not consider this evidence for the other counts. All that Judge Hogan said, and this is at our joint appendix at page 469, to 70. All the judge said was not to consider the prior conviction for the purpose of the gun count. And I think when you look at when the evidence actually came in.
What were the judge's words?
In that instance?
Yeah. You gave us a synopsis. You did like the clerk's letter.
The judge said, this is at page 470, this prior conviction should not be in any way considered by you for the purpose of determining whether Mr. Smith possessed the firearm on June 19, 2007. So I think that given the fact that the jury wasn't even explicitly told that they can't consider this evidence for the other counts, I think it's exactly like the situation in the Dockery case, which Judge Ginsburg, I think, served on the panel in that case. And that case held that where similar evidence had come in, the judge hadn't taken the extensive steps necessary to safeguard the prejudice from spilling over onto the other counts. And so I would just refer the panel to that decision. The other point I'd like to make here is that the interpretation issue was certainly preserved. Not only did this come up in the pretrial opposition, in our pretrial opposition to the motion in limine, but if you look at the joint appendix on page 160, you'll see that as soon as Agent Bevington started his interpretation testimony, very early in that testimony, there was an issue raised with the court about whether counsel would need to raise these objections on, I think, a, quote, line-by-line basis. And the exact exchange was, trial counsel said, Your Honor, how would you like for us to do this? Because Mr. Ernest and I were reading some cases where the Court of Appeals, it wasn't D.C. cases, where the attorneys hadn't objected line-by-line, that they objected to codes but didn't object to summary statements, and therefore on appeal it affected the appeal. What do you want us to do? And then Judge Hogan says, I understand from the role of the court that this is a newfound objection. I recognize what it's about. And then counsel says, thank you. And I think that exchange clearly shows that he completely understood what the objection was, and he was absolving counsel of the need to continue objecting to every single interpretation and every opinion that Agent Bevington offered.
We've gone past your time again. I believe you were appointed to represent the defendant appellant in this case, and the court thanks you for your assistance to the court and to the United States.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Case is submitted.